Hello, and welcome to Blood, Sweat, and Careers, the podcast where we discuss multi-hyphenates, dig deep into hustle culture, and find hobbies to prepare ourselves for 2021 not being that much different from 2020. We're your hosts, Mallory, Austin, and Catherine. Hi, guys. We're back.
Hey, hey, hey.
Episode 6.
Woohoo.
And this is your host, Mallory. I'm an igloo architect and a woman who skis uphill. Or as my co-host would have preferred me to say, someone who skins.
What?
Exactly. No one knows what it is.
I mean, ski touring is a thing.
What's skins?
But like when you call it a woman who skins, it also kind of sounds like...
Skins bodies?
Maybe.
Oh, fine.
I don't know.
You'll edit it, I'm sure. Make it perfect.
I will.
It's going to be great.
I'm Austin, makeup artist and sandwich artist.
And I'm Catherine, an embroiderer and MFA student at her wit's end.
Hey, guys. That's us.
That is
hey, girl,
us.
Hey.
So this week, like every week, we're going to try to explain what a multi-hyphenate is. And much like our recent guests, Brittany Crockett and Kate McKiernan, a multi-hyphenate can be a communication specialist / social equity startup director, or a writer / candle maker / hospitality veteran. And if you want to hear those stories, you should listen to episodes 4 and 5. But we are taking a term that was originally created in the 1970s in Hollywood that was used to describe a singer - dancer - actor. And we're using that term and we're broadening it to include freelance and gigs and multi-passionate professionals all over who are just trying to pay their rent. So that's what a multi-hyphenate is.
Amen.
New way to survive 2020.
Any Ooh. Way we can.
Yeah. No one gets out alive.
We're never leaving.
So each week we try to talk about one multi-hyphenate that we admire. And I feel like AOC should be at the top of many people's lists.
Yeah. And we chose her because she is not only in our age demo, so it definitely feels like someone who will relate to the conversation ahead, but also because she's a wonderful example of someone in the public eye who's absolutely a multi-hyphenate. She started off her studies in school, being into science and math, even studied abroad and was working at a maternity clinic. Did a hard pivot, it sounds like, during college and also was doing some politics. So she interned at the late Ted Kennedy's office. But upon graduating, was overcome by the debt her family was in and saw her mom almost lose her house a couple times. And so took on not only the job of being the director, editorial director of a National Hispanic Institute, where she was working kind of almost with this beginning stages of grassroots organizing. But she was also a bartender and worked at Flats Fix in Manhattan's Union Square. So that's a story I think we're all kind of somewhat familiar with. She started her campaign still being a bartender. And so she basically make the switch. It sounds like changing her shoes on a subway platform while scurrying from one job to the next. And ultimately has once elected in kind of a surprise election, if you will. She won her primary and garnered national attention for it. Has also skyrocketed to be one of the most famous, if you will, and potentially one of the most influential people in the House of Representatives, part of the so-called squad. Another interesting piece to her multi-hyphenism, and I know you guys probably have more to say on this topic, is her beauty influencer status. In the Vanity Fair article that we read, they talk about her moonlighting as a beauty influencer because she has these quintessential red lips that she wears almost as a power statement, but also is more than willing to tell people how to get them and is honestly constantly looking very, very beautiful.
She gets my full support on the red lip. She always looks super, super put together. I love AOC.
She's got great style.
And interestingly enough, she welcomes that. Like that was another fun part about the article is a lot of older women in politics tend to shy away from wanting to talk about their appearance, wanting to be written up about what they look like, but AOC seems in almost that perfect multi-hyphenate way capable of handling both her influential power as a congresswoman and her influence as a beauty influencer, so to speak, on Instagram or TikTok or wherever you might find her.
Yeah, AOC is amazing. And I think something that she's really beloved for is that she really does seem like kind of a woman of the people. And she has this background in hospitality with the bartending and coming out of college with this debt and living like a real American story of having to worry about money. And that ties in really well with our subject this week, which is not buying diamonds. Which, funny enough, we actually thought about naming the podcast, but we were really late on this idea. Not Buying Diamonds was an article that The Economist put out in 2016, and it was all about why we, as millennials, are selfishly not purchasing diamonds anymore. Do you guys have a lot of diamonds?
Mm-hmm. One big rock that I'm not wearing.
A big collection of diamonds. Basically, it set off this trend in the media of now when you Google millennials in the context, a lot of times these are articles that are like, millennials are killing the diamond industry, or millennials are killing napkins, or killing McDonald's, or killing mayonnaise, or the wedding industry, or whatever. We're killing it. But in a bad way, apparently. We're just not spending money the same way that our parents did, and a lot of times that gets framed in this way of millennials are choosing to make these decisions for whatever reason. And a lot of times there's this lack of thought put behind like, well, why wouldn't someone who was born in the late 80s want to purchase a $15,000 diamond ring that doesn't serve much of a purpose?
Yeah, I think it's kind of the combination of us being one of the biggest generations in the purchase, you know, that we're ready, we have jobs, we're supposed to be buying all the things. And then all of a sudden, all these industries are suffering under our watch. We're not investing in diamonds or napkins. And it just,
I love that, under our watch.
It felt, yeah, like a great way to dive into the economic side of this multi-hyphenate chat that we're going to have week to week. And also break it all down for you guys.
Yeah, we watched some pretty depressing specials and articles about why this is not all just in our heads, essentially.
Right. It was definitely validating the things that we researched to talk about and we'll be talking about, I think. But it, as you said, Catherine, it is depressing and a little bit difficult to feel like it's being double underscored, that it isn't just, you know, a phantom of our imaginations, but instead really this crazy reality that we're living in.
Yeah, we're going to try to have a lot of fun talking about something that is not super fun. And that is the whole economic reality of our generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, if we start off with like the facts. So we graduated, and I say the royal we, but also us personally in this room, you know, graduated with university costing twice as much as our parents. Mm-hmm. Salaries are also 20% less than our parents. And we're the most educated as well as productive generation. But there's a lot of this conversation that the millennials are killing. It really is acting like this. These are entirely decisions that are our right. fault.
And that we're living in kind of a staid reality, like as if it was still 1970 something or 80 something, that we're not there. We're in 2020, or maybe even, as you were implying, Catherine, too, jumping back when we came to the workforce, it was early 2010s. And there was an economic crisis that we rolled right into.
When we watched this like NBC news special, and we can put a link in the show notes, but it's pretty much saying like millennials might be the unluckiest generation in modern history because of the timing, which, you know, timing has a lot to do with it. I think there's this idea that we're not working hard, or there's this like gaslighting in modern media, even for Gen Z, that we're just like too self-absorbed. We just want free time. We want flexibility. How dare we want flexibility right. in our workplace. And so, you know, millennials struggle to buy a home, save for emergencies. And then we've also waited longer to get married and have kids. though I'd love to hear your thoughts, because I also think there's just like a part of us that have, we're also a little smarter. Like some of these things, like, is it really number one priority to get married and have kids by the time you're 22, like our parents?
Well, definitely not in this economy. Having kids was not something that was really on my to-do list anyway. But I mean, I think about my friends who are having kids and thinking about having kids or putting off having kids, and all of the other big financial decisions of buying homes and even buying cars. These are all really big decisions to make in an economy and in a situation where who knows what's going to happen. It just seems really scary to make big long-term decisions like that anymore.
Definitely. And I think that who knows what's going to happen attitude to the, what Catherine was saying a little bit ago didn't happen by accident either. I don't know that our parents were as, that wasn't as massaged into their psyche as it feels like our generation had it massaged into ours, because we did, again, come of age during a financial crisis. And then I think, interestingly enough, I think what one of the pieces that we read called it the millennial 1-2 punch, but we came of age trying to find jobs, get situated during 2008, and then getting into our 30s, 2020s here. And all of a sudden, we're now being impacted by not only a pandemic, but what is looking like another financial upheaval. And the people affected most greatly by this upheaval are certainly the people with the least stability. So that's not all only millennials by any stretch, certainly not only people that are multi-hyphenates, but it's definitely a cross-section of both of those for sure. People our age and people trying to work multiple jobs who maybe don't have health insurance or don't have a stable 401k situation, we're being impacted again. It's depressing. I can see by your faces that we're clearly riveted by this.
Wah, wah.
But I think all we can do is really compare to the past and talk about our present and hopefully maybe end by looking forward. But it does feel like between when we were supposed to be starting a career, we talked about this, I think, in the very first episode, we entered into jobs where people weren't leaving.
Yeah.
And now we're here.
Or had just been fired. Right. Like a bunch of people, like our hiring freezes, or you're competing with someone who has decades of experience.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, that's kind of one of the things I was curious. I know we touched on it, but like, where were you guys in 2008 and maybe the next 3 to 4 years? It might be interesting to sort of set that up for everybody too. Like Austin, where were you? 2008, New Year's. Happy New Year's, everyone. Where are you?
Happy New Year's, 2008. So my story is obviously different from both of yours and a lot of people, because I wasn't getting out of college because I dropped out of high school so that I could start working as soon as I could. And I had already been working for several years by 2008. But at 2008, I was working for a high-end retailer, working in makeup for kind of like a bougie brand. But I remember it being a really hard time business-wise for us, as it was for everybody. And the directives that we were getting from management was like, we understand that this thing might be happening in the world, but that shouldn't really affect your ability to do your job. So keep selling lipstick, everybody.
Wow.
So it was, I mean,
up.
Yeah. In the retail world, it was a very strange time of management sort of pretending that there wasn't a recession when there absolutely was. I had been living on my own for a while by that point. And, you know, speaking of instability, renting throughout all of this has been really, really hard.
Totally.
Renting throughout all of what?
Throughout all of the like economic turmoil of our adulthood, essentially.
It's basically expensive.
Renting is super expensive, and not being in a place where you can afford to buy, or you're not, you know, prepared financially to buy, is just a really difficult place to be. The current statistics that I was looking up earlier is that 49% of renters in the US are under 30, which is just insane. That's
crazy.
Like, yeah. Half of us are not in a position to be buying a home, and
the other half are living with their parents.
Right.
But
or like roommates upon roommates.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. 49. That's a lot. I mean, on the one hand, it's not that shocking because sure, you're young, you're in college, you're renting, whatever. But on the other hand, I think the point you're underscoring is what we're renting is super expensive. Like somebody, was it you, Catherine, found that New York rent in the 1970s was $108. The medium rental costs that much a month. Like, that's like my Target bill yesterday.
By the way, that includes utilities. That's statistic.
So nuts.
Well, and I wonder, like, for inflation, do we know what that would be?
That is a good thing. We should look that up.
I'm going to Google that right now.
Again, I dropped out of high school, so I would not be the one to be.
I go to the Oracle.
Well, you curated that fact, Austin. I miscredit it. Thank you. But I also know that Catherine would know, by comparison today, maybe, Catherine, you've been looking at apartments. Give us a number. Do you mind? What's a medium in rent? Granted, we also should asterisk this. You're looking during a pandemic, so rent is already plummeted.
Well, exactly. So I can say at least with what rents have been, it would probably be like $2,300 for a one bedroom.
Whew.
And that's a pretty good deal depending on your neighborhood.
Yeah.
But I was looking recently, fingers crossed. It's like a loft in Soho, which is a very high-end neighborhood these days. And I could sublet for like $1,500.
Wow. Which is great.
So, which is still for most of the United States, a hefty sum, but for New York.
Yeah. It's funny because, and what's funny, I don't know why I said that, but when I do think back to my favorite apartment, my neighbor to Austin apartment in LA, when we first moved in, the rent was $1,500. It was two bed, two bath. The area itself was awesome, but in many ways, not like the peak of what it became. By the time we moved out, I don't think I could have afforded my apartment anymore. And that was 4 years, 5 years.
Yeah.
Our rent only could go up so much. Thank God. I think in LA, they have some restrictions on how once you're in, your rent can go up. But as soon as my final roommate moved out, we said goodbye to the apartment and I like literally shed real tears because I'm like, bye forever. I don't think I'll ever be able to afford you again, even though.
Yeah, that the apartment that I lived across the street from you in was around $1,400, one bedroom, one bathroom, but it was a really good size. And by the time I moved out, I'm sure she ended up renting that unit for over $2,000 five years later.
And you, no garage, nothing like that for you. And
no.
Yeah, it's just, I think, not to belabor it, but it does feel like the portion of your paycheck going to rent, you know, good investors, right? They tell you it should be no more than 30% going to housing. That's absolutely not the case today. Nope. as far as what somebody starting off in a career or even maybe midway through a career is making compared to where they're living. Often it's much more. Catherine, where were you in 2008? What were you doing?
Well, I will say, I don't know how much of we'll actually keep of that, of us like going through different rental prices, but just in case we do, the inflation from $108 for a New York City apartment in 1970, today would still just be $736. So now, granted, USDinflation.com may not be completely incorrect, but fun fact.
We will link to them in the show notes.
So I had my last year of college in 2008. So I graduated in December. And even when I was looking, I mean, I think I ended up having like an extra semester because I switched. None of that is interesting, but
it was actually you switched housing, career paths, boyfriends.
Sorry, I'll shut up. Go ahead. I switched majors, but I did end up moving. That I guess I spent the summer in Michigan. Speaking of rent, I was spending $438 for a one-bedroom apartment in Michigan in 2007. And I remember thinking, like, This is a lot of money. You know what? I can do it.
I knew a version of you when I studied abroad. I met a girl, which I may have talked about in the first episode, who was living in Kentucky and was renting a full house, many bedrooms, many bathrooms, a basement, all the things, a yard. And I think she was paying somewhere in the like $200 to $300 a month in rent. And I'm just like, okay, I'm in like subsidized student, literally called the Brotel housing. And it's still over $500 for my single bedroom, like my room. Mm-hmm. I don't even have my own bathroom or anything. That's so crazy. I mean, that's also like the coastal elitism, maybe a little of it too. But
well, I was going to say, I would be interested because you both now own a home. You're both homeowners. So quick clap for that.
Pat on the back for us.
Thank you.
But it is interesting to me because when we've all lived in Los Angeles, and when I was living there, talking with friends, and I still have friends there who, you know, were like, we'll never be able to buy a home in this city. Probably wouldn't have been able to buy a home for a very long time, but even especially with the way the housing market has exploded. So I would be curious, like you both, what you think about that. I mean, I guess you obviously didn't like, I don't know, were you trying to buy a house in LA? Was it a conscious decision to move out of state? Or was it something like, I'm ready to get out of this town now because I'm of a certain age or at a certain place?
For me, I mean, the idea was, we said this a million times, that owning a house in LA was never going to happen because moving to a two-bedroom apartment in LA was never going to happen. Making the most money that my husband and I both made in our entire lives, like good jobs, moving to a two-bedroom apartment would have cramped our lifestyle essentially to a degree that it would not have made sense. All of the money would just have gone to the apartment. When I lost my job at the beginning of this year, and the idea was to move to Utah because I have family here, we had a short list of other places that we might consider living. We thought about Phoenix, we thought about Denver, and we ended up choosing Utah because I have family here and because of the cost of living being pretty cheap. And we decided that we would rent for a year so that we could kind of figure out things and make sure that we liked it and that we wanted to stay. And as soon as we started looking at the rental prices here, it was immediately clear that that wasn't really an option either.
Interesting.
We would have paid the same amount of money that we were already paying in LA, and for that we would have gotten a second bedroom, but essentially the cost of renting here for what we needed was going to be the same. And then when I started looking at housing prices, we pay hundreds of dollars less a month on our mortgage than we did on our rent in LA. So it ended up being really the only choice that we could make. And full disclosure, like, it was not an easy process. You can't just show up and buy a house. There had to be monies in place for that. And we are lucky and privileged that we had the type of savings that we had accrued while we lived in LA. So we were able to buy a house, and it was the much cheaper option, but it was not at all what we expected to be doing.
I would say my answer to that too is so similar, but yet also walks a different line, in that all of my living in with my husband occurred because of some financial decisions that also had to be made. I mean, I love him very deeply. There's lots of love there. But initially, we moved in together out of college because we knew we'd be spending time together, one, but also we weren't going to be able to afford the type of apartments we wanted to separately. And so I think part of my story I've always thought was like the luck and also the necessity sometimes of our generation's need to be in a partnership of some kind to live in this really cool area. But that only lasted 9 months because that was drowning us. That was so expensive. Even in, I think it was like 2011 when we moved to Hermosa Beach, and it's still my dream place. I'd love to go back, but definitely within 9 months had to move away. And as I mentioned, found the apartment where I was neighbors with Austin and lived there for a long time. And I think during that period, felt again grateful to have the partner in Brian. And we brought in a roommate. So it was a really good and pretty easy financial experience for most of that. But as I got older, honestly, I started reflecting, and it was that choice, like the house next door to our apartment where my car had been stolen and broken into, the house next door to us was for sale. And I think it was like a 3-bed, 2-bath for sale for like $1.2 or $1.4 million.
Yep.
And it was kind of upon seeing that, that both Brian and I realized like, no, we're never going to be able to afford that if we don't, you know, you have to get in the game to play the game, and we weren't in the game yet. On that same note, I think it's just a shout out to anybody who's trying to do this by themselves or trying to do this without a partner. It's so expensive, you know, being half to a whole was expensive. I can't imagine trying to be the whole.
I mean, I'm trying to rack my brain for people that I know who are single and live alone in Los Angeles County.
Yeah.
Living by yourself in California is almost impossible.
Because you do have to kind of skate around the city and find the place. Like Echo Park, maybe at one time you could have done that. You certainly can't do that today. Maybe, you know, not, again, not a podcast about LA, but we've all lived there. So it feels like the common language.
Do you guys feel like the work that you are doing now and kind of your multi-hyphenate story has more to do with your multi-passions, or do you feel like you were kind of corralled into this lifestyle by the economic circumstances when you got out of school?
I mean, I feel like my answer is not entirely satisfying just because I did graduate in 2008, and we learned that your first job really sets you up on a trajectory. And I did not have a great trajectory. I did some really interesting kind of part-time freelance work, working as a reporter for a weekly newspaper out in LA. But my career has been very much shaped by being laid off 3 different times and really having to take a lot of jobs out of necessity versus passion, to be straight up. I've been fortunate in a lot of ways that writing has somehow, whether it was through going after social media or whether that was doing freelance writing on the side, or even when I was working in PR, I know a lot of people were just really excited to hear that they had someone who could string sentences together. I don't know if that's like the
can
best
you spell?
Endorsement.
Yes, you're hired.
Yeah. I mean, I was always a little shocked that they're just like, man, we really need somebody who knows editing and writing on the team. But I really feel like I have, within the last year, have gotten a lot more comfortable of like, okay, I own my own business. Yes, I own my own business because I got laid off for the final time and was like, okay, let me take a hard pause with this, because whatever these balls that I keep chasing, it's not working out in the way that I thought it was. And I think a lot of people can probably relate in 2020, if not before, that this idea of this stability through a company or a brand is a little bit of a fallacy. There's no safety net in the US. Like, you can be fired at any time.
Mm-hmm. So weird. So wild to realize that.
And I have been fired at many times.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I feel like I've been thrust into this because I had to, and I had to figure out a way to create stability for myself, and I'm much happier for it. I didn't mean to make that sound like a question. But there's this allure of, oh man, if I just had a 9-to-5 and I could just leave it at work and go home and have the healthcare that, but you know, I even look back and I'm like, I never had this choice healthcare plan that I was like, man, I'm really getting my teeth done this year.
LASIK eye surgery, here I come.
Yeah.
That kind of feels like a funny myth of our generation too, of these jobs that exist in the world where you're only working 37 and a half hours a week. And when you go home, you don't think about it.
Oh my God, smartphones changed that. There's no chance.
No, not at all.
Yes.
Everyone is available all the time. Even people who work kind of generic 9-to-5 jobs, I feel like everyone just goes home and kind of hates that, don't they?
Well, this is a hard pivot for me. I wasn't expecting to say this, so I'm going to need to do the back end research to make sure we can put it in the show notes. But there's an individual who spoke to my fellow employees at the job I have now, that was so interesting because they were really putting in stark contrast this idea that there's been a bit of a leaving of the church, so to speak, people not being as religious, not seeking meaning in of life in religion, and this simultaneous kind of like raising of the other side of the scale of us putting so much, as you've said, Austin, investment into who we are in our jobs and making our jobs kind of like defining of who we are and how we relate to the world.
I'm going to say that's a good point. There is this idea of a millennial generation where we want to be these like change makers. And I think that can work in a positive and also to our detriment, of that we like have a tendency to throw ourselves into these jobs and look for meaning and look for purpose. And so, you know, I myself work with purpose-driven businesses, and I think that's really great to be mission-driven and or a nonprofit. But then that also can mean, like you said, like we're not leaving these things at home, and we don't necessarily have the kids and the family to take focus and give a different perspective. Not everybody needs that.
Well, and it's not all bad either. I think like purpose-driven in a corporate sense is actually really important, and is part of the reason things fell apart the way they did, because people were not caring for their employee. They weren't caring for the environment. They were not concerned about the future of the planet, the generations to come. You know, that's a short-term gain. But I think at the other side of it is also like having pride in what you do is powerful and important. But I think it's almost this morphing of pride into purpose for the individual that can be really difficult. But I also don't know that all along, every step of my career, I've been like, yeah, for sure, I'm seeing through a big and beautiful change on this planet. And that can be kind of scary to say out loud. Like, I don't want to be known as somebody who just went in, made a check and went home per se. But it's also so burdensome to be feeling like, okay, well, your job needs to be so purpose-driven. It needs to define your integrity.
Well, you brought up such a good point, and I'm really glad that we're talking about this, because this is totally a side of this conversation that I hadn't given thought to. And what you said, Mallory, is that people made more money, equating for inflation, back in the day. So our parents and our grandparents were making enough money out of school, or even if they didn't go to school, in whatever jobs they were doing, people were getting paid enough, and the cost of living was low enough nationally that you could find purpose in other places. Work was where you made your money, and then you spent that money on things that brought you joy and things that fulfilled you in other ways. And because of the stagnation of wages and minimum wage going up so slowly, I just don't think we have that same option, because so much of our income has to go to just paying for us to live, that right. There's so little left over a lot of times that, you know, we're not affording families like people could. And so it does, I think, fall on our workplace a lot of time, or what we're doing with our hobbies and our careers and our gigs and our multi-hyphenate lives.
It's something crazy. Like, I think in the 1970s, if we had, when minimum wage started to stagnate, and we've gone up, what, like it's $1.50. It's something so small. We would need to make $25 an hour for what things cost and for inflation in the 1970s. So,
yeah.
You know, to put that in perspective, like it's not,
well, and I like the idea of what you're saying too, Austin, in combination with what Catherine said before, the gaslighting of millennials too. Maybe there's a small gaslighting going on where we want our companies to be purpose-driven. We need our leaders in corporations to be leading in ways maybe we wouldn't have had business not exploded the way it did. Like today, we need Amazon to do certain things because of how much of the economy they control. We need Google and Facebook, and we need these corporations to be pivoting and be more purpose-driven. And we are investing and looking for these purpose-driven companies in ways maybe that it's important and crucial, but also to your point, like feels like, that's a selling point to us now. Like, hey, I'm doing something good. And it's kind of like, well, shouldn't you always have been paying people well and investing in future and affording a life for the next generation and
not polluting the rainforest? Right?
Like, well, come on.
I think part of that is also that back in the day, that type of wealth that exists today amongst the top 1%, like rich people today are so much richer and the wealth gap is insane. But yeah, people with that much money should be doing good things because it wouldn't even be that hard. And so when I just heard the other day, like if Jeff Bezos took $1 billion and put it into an account by itself, that the interest on that could just pay for school lunches forever.
Really?
Wow.
Why not just do better things?
Be better.
Be best. Better.
Be best. No.
Don't.
Ugh, Melania.
I mean, that's also by design.
Oh, yeah.
There's a reason wages are staying stagnant, because if people actually had to pay, I don't know, workers a living wage, Jeff Bezos would not be so rich. Right. So it gets back to that gaslighting where, you know, I do think it's interesting that more and more people now are working in service industry. I mean, not at the moment, which it'd be interesting to see like what kind of ramifications that has.
Huge. Yeah. I guess I also wanted to say the flip side of the coin, at least in my own life too, is with your question, is the system betraying us or choosing our way? I've obviously made a healthy argument for how it's betrayed us. But I do think that in looking back at my career, I am so grateful to have kind of gone through the twists and turns I have. And I remember distinctly having a conversation with one of my really good friends at a point where in my career where I was feeling really scared and stuck and lost. And she, by contrast, was in school to be a doctor, like had known that's what she wanted to do since she was a young girl. And she was waist deep in this education. And we were talking about our careers, and she helped me see, aside to my experience that I hadn't been able to see, which was just her inability to change or maneuver or experience some of the things that I got to, was something she had some, not regrets, too strong a word, but just had some feelings about. And I think it was a great way to see kind of the both sides-ism of it. You know, I'm envious of her and her ability to know what she wants to do, but I so appreciated her ability to see what I was doing with some sense of admiration as well, feeling like, well, you're getting to go be a young 20 something and figure it out. And you're getting to go do experiences that I'm not going to have. I'm going to be in school until I'm in my 30s, et cetera.
I do really like that point. I think in some ways we are really lucky that we have the opportunities to kind of bounce around and try different things, as stressful as that can be. It's definitely full of traps and tricks like we talk about all the time. Yeah, I think it is different, very different for people who have chosen careers very early on. I have a friend who just got her doctorate a couple years ago in some sort of microbiology field. And she was in school for like forever, and she's finally doing the thing she wanted to do. And the pay isn't very good from what she has told me, which seems really upsetting that you would just like live under this mountain of debt going to school to get a doctorate in this thing that you're really passionate about. And it's not even a job that you get to retire young on or whatever it is that you would want to do with a bunch of money.
The same with my friend who's a medical doctor. She's explained to me some conversations she's had with older doctors, you know, that are like, just slog through this. It's a hard being an intern or being a resident or whatever, but it gets better. And her colleagues being like, but see, you're not under the same amount of debt that we are. And so I think even those jobs are resonating with this conversation that we're having. They're also not being set up by a great system and have major pitfalls within them. You know, I think bankers on Wall Street aren't making the buku bucks that the Wolf of Wall Street was making. Like, those guys are even not getting as rich. And so
let's hope not. whatever crashed us in the beginning, let's not do that again. And I think it kind of loops back in with the AOC conversation, in that I think we look at kind of the 70s as this like pinnacle, or even the 50s and 60s really, this pinnacle of industrialization, and like our grandparents, like when they were working hard and having lots of kids. And then we've shifted since the 70s to a sharp decline in manufacturing, and everyone's gone into service industries, which is this very different paid, if you're paid and not just surviving on tips, type of lifestyle. But did you guys see I don't remember which video now it is.
Unlivable wage is the one that dug deep into the...
Which is wild. I'd had no idea. Like, of course it's the US. So of course it's all about slavery and racism. And that's why we have tipping.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is a really messed up system. And we actually just talked about this in our episode where we interviewed Kate. But the service industry is so hard, and it is not set up to like take care of people.
Right.
No.
And I think, to touch on what you were just saying, Catherine, too, about the tips, the idea of tipping started off as an add to a wage. So a job well done, or something on top of an expected income. And then, to your point, in the US, when the restaurant industry was coming into its own, the people working in it were previously enslaved Black women. And instead of paying them a salary, the idea switched and became that the tip was the wage. There was no more tipping on top of. And we've kept that. And I think both working in it and managing in it and all of the things, there's pros and cons in a lot of it. I think the link we'll share and the video we watched definitely hits it hard, that the restaurant, what did she call it? The other NRA, the National Restaurant Association, is not always advocating for its workers. The counterpoint to that, I do just want to say, is in this recent pandemic, when restaurants have been hit so hard, 2020, I think that's kind of why we wanted to start talking about the service industry, the restaurant industry specifically, but gigging as well. That's been the number one industry hit by the pandemic. You just can't easily go and dine at a place or run a restaurant. But
sure,
that being said, the NRA, the National Restaurant Association, did advocate for keeping people in the job. Granted, that's a both-and-ism. They've got cheap labor, maybe. They want to keep the cheap labor there. But I will give them the props of recent, that they were working hard to get added insurance and get people added income. At least in the state of Colorado.
Is the minimum wage for waitstaff in Colorado, what is the cash minimum?
It's gone up. It's $7.25, I believe. But
for waiters?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
wow.
They do make dollars and cents each hour.
Wow.
For sure.
I was just looking up for my statistics stuff that I was checking out today. It's still only $2.13 in Utah for minimum hourly wage for waitstaff, which is less than the national minimum wage in 1976. So that's a real fun statistic.
Yeah.
And hopefully these people are making quite a bit more than that in tips, but not only just in the pandemic when restaurants are closing down and people are not going out to eat, but pre-COVID. It's an insane idea that you would pay somebody $2.13 an hour and then just hope that they make up the rest of whatever they need. And this is also like inside baseball, but there's a lot of, having worked in restaurants, some restaurants let you keep all of your tips. Some restaurants make you share your tips with other people who maybe aren't earning as many tips. And that's, you know, that's a tricky situation to say who's right or wrong there. But I've done hosting at restaurants where you don't get tipped by anybody. So part of your wage is your tip share that the waiters have to pay you out on. And it's a terrible system. The whole thing is terrible.
I need to make a correction too, just quickly before we get too far. So the minimum wage for a tipped employee in Colorado is $8.98. It has gone up since 2018. It was $7.18 and then went up 90 cents and then again in 2020. So,
oh, nice.
Dang, they're rolling.
But that's also, I wanted to say, we're like hilarious because both all our faces are like, wow, not bad. Really? Are we kidding?
Really?
Like the minimum wage we're fighting for is $15. And so,
right.
Yeah. I mean, granted.
I mean, I'm sorry, my sarcasm, I don't think it translated well enough. I mean, 1 in 11 Americans work in the restaurant industry. So, I mean, there's a lot of people hurting out there. Yeah. Like you were saying, Austin, for people who aren't sitting down in restaurants, like, how are you supposed to people just don't tip the same way on to-go orders.
I try so hard because we don't order nearly as much now because there's nowhere that delivers to where I live. But when I do order from the same two restaurants as often as I do, I always really try to tip like at least 20%, which, you know, it sucks, but also it sucks to be poor and to be working in essential jobs where you have to be out in the world so that you can pay your bills, or me staying home, trying to be safe and living off of one income for two people. You know, I do try to do my part for that.
Totally. Well, and I think that's also something that they touched on in the unlivable wage piece, was this idea that it's the burden's also kind of falling into the wrong lap, so to speak. It's just like a confusing industry to try to write at this point. And hopefully we can. And maybe with the economy collapse in the way it has, the hospitality industry will see a beautiful change. But it is hard when it's the guest who's paying the server.
It's always such a, like, it's always a really infuriating number when you hear, like, if we're going to pay people who work at McDonald's $15 an hour, then we'd have to raise the price of French fries by 11 cents. Oh, well, that's, I would pay that.
Right. That's not hardly anything. Okay.
I've grown up in this industry and have family that have, you know, run restaurants and have married to someone who works in the restaurant industry. And so I think on that same level, there's like so many good people in this space too, trying to do the right thing. Like, I know my husband has health insurance. I know that in my family, the retention of employees at the restaurant has been remarkable. People have worked there for 30 years. And I don't think it's because they, you know, couldn't do something else, but it is because they truly take pride and enjoy the work and like the place that they're working. So it's definitely this murky water we're wading in. And I think there's, you know, a huge difference between McDonald's and a mom and pop restaurant doing the right thing. But that being said, it is kind of all lumped in at a certain point too, like no getting around it. These people are looking to tips for a big part of what they make. And, you know, if an owner isn't as generous or isn't as aware of what will keep and retain a good employee, they don't necessarily suffer, you know, whatever, hire the next high school kid who needs a job. And I think that's the other piece of it that's always bugged me as well, is there's that the unlivable wage touched on, is the pride again in your work. Like, these people have pride. They like what they're doing. Maybe they fell into it in a different way, or some of them have chosen it, or some of them are doing it as a multi-hyphenate looking to get, you know, pieces of income to support a different dream. But either way, none of that really, you know, matters, because they're, for the most part, all taking pride in what they're doing and just want to be honored for the work that they're doing.
Yeah. And I think you put it well, that there's a lot of complexity to the restaurant industry. And I don't think any of us are trying to say that the people, there's anything wrong working in the restaurant industry. And it can be a super fun job, and like, people can make absolutely a living wage at it. It also has a lot of inherent issues of how, like, someone in a tourist destination like we are, or versus someone in middle America, is making a very different wage and a very different lifestyle based on a system that's set up, putting a lot of onus on the individual worker.
For sure. You're working at Denny's or McDonald's versus working at a high-end restaurant in Aspen. Like, those are completely different experiences. And, and you know, careers are made. I think it's, like you said, it can be so fun. And it's definitely an industry that has a lot of nuance to the career path. You know, you can be a sommelier, or you can be a restaurant owner, franchisee. Like, there's lots of ways to make a wonderful living and have a great experience. But I think the stark reality that COVID brought to the forefront was that what you said earlier, Catherine, is a lot of people previously had been working in factories or mines and are now turning to the service industry as that job that is available for an individual who maybe has limited schooling or didn't, you know, come out of college with a path per se and moved into hospitality. But that COVID has really, what am I trying to even say? I guess just to reiterate that COVID is creating an obvious chasm in this industry and something for us to talk about, look at, and try to fix.
I think that also brings up an interesting, and this is kind of a sidebar, but COVID has also brought up this reality that people in the service industry don't have stability in their jobs like other industries have, because when all of the restaurants shut down and you're not working, you are now without money, but you're also without healthcare, as so many people in the country are now. And I think it also makes a very strong case for universal healthcare, as we're the only first world nation that doesn't just give that to people for the taxes that they're already paying. But that's probably a whole other episode's worth of grievances to air.
Oh, yeah. Hear, hear.
Which, to be stat girl again, I think we all looked at Data for Progress did a really interesting survey. And on that same kind of spirit, we're asking people, how do they rely on their gig work, so to speak, or this side hustle, if you will. We'll link to it in the show notes for sure. But what it did nicely was provide graphs that dug in to the question of basically, what does your gig or side hustle mean to your income, the livability of your life? And it started with the question of how important is income, the income you earn from gig work. And 45% of respondents said that it was essential. 32% said it was important. So they were taking it into consideration in their monthly budget. And only 24% of people responded saying that it was just nice to have. They weren't dependent on it in any real way. And then they kept digging, and it was just super interesting how it broke down against across age groups. Again, leaning into this idea of millennials, why we're not buying diamonds. Well, 34% of the people that responded that were 18 to 29 years old of age said that it was essential or important for them to have this income. And then people in their 30s and 40s were saying that it was also essential at a rate of 33% of the respondents. Definitely this article is super interesting in terms of talking to that point directly. This wasn't necessarily, you know, inclusive of all of America. It's not necessarily inclusive of all gig workers, but it at least was looking at this idea of somebody who's working a job like Lyft or Uber, or taking on extra hours doing something outside of what they might consider their day job to be, or their gravitational force of their career, if you will.
Well, and it is interesting that, you know, it's these, we're talking about the racial disparities, and Black and Hispanic people have largely been overrepresented in insecure work and among gig workers. So I think it was like 21% of them, of the gig workers who responded to the survey, identify as Black, which 14% of the US population does. So it's, you know, definitely a skew there about people who need these additional options to make income versus the, what is a great and also applicable idea of a multi-hyphenate, multi-passionate person. There's still this very much large sector of gig workers and multi-hyphenates who are doing this because this is how you survive in today's economy.
So I think just to round this conversation out, we can actually take it back to the beginning, since Catherine just pointed out that we didn't talk a lot about diamonds in this discussion, but it is something that
we've
factored in. It is really more of a metaphor than not buying diamonds.
Right. Well, I guess it's more of that we can, it's the system around diamonds. It's very, it does, you're right. It does work as a metaphor in terms of, you know, there's no actual real value in a diamond. The moment you walk out of a jewelry store, you lose 50% of its value. It's similar to a car. And so, you know, we were talking about how maybe as millennials and Gen Z, we're smarter in different ways because we we can kind of see through the smoke and mirrors of some of these industries that, like, yes, cars are valuable. Yes, there's something inherently beautiful and romantic about the symbol of a diamond ring, but we also don't necessarily have the kind of ability to have the romanticism about these ideas when your paycheck is not going to justify investing in a $15,000 piece of jewelry when something you can find symbolism in other ways.
Ironically, I am spending a lot of money on jewelry for myself.
Yeah.
But no diamonds. And not lately, because I don't leave my house and there's no one to see it. This was actually, we started this conversation several episodes ago, but when I said that I own a lot of jewelry and I carry a handbag, I think I kind of painted a weird picture of myself, but I usually wear suits and like a large pin or brooch. And
let's definitely specify. I love that.
Yeah. I love a brooch. And I've spent an obscene amount of money on jewelry in the past 3 years, but not since I lost my job.
You're always dressed beautifully, Austin.
That's true.
Well, I'm really glad that we had this whole conversation. It was one that we had talked about from the very beginning of the inception of the podcast, was kind of going over the socioeconomic factors that have led us to live this multi-hyphenate life. And I think we covered some bases, and there's always more to go over, but I'm definitely thinking about things differently than I even had before we talked about it. So if you guys have questions or thoughts, please definitely send them to our social medias. Now we're going to break it up a little bit and add some positive spin to kind of a tough conversation week. And we just wanted to discuss a few things that we were looking forward to in this almost 2021 time by the time this podcast airs. So, Catherine, do you have anything you're looking forward to in the coming year?
The thing that I got excited about is that we're talking about, there's all these difficulties in terms of, you know, buying a home and finding stability in our jobs. And while 2020 has absolutely been a dumpster fire for everyone, the availability, and I think that the rapid shift that we've made in the, just as workers, being able to work from home, work remotely, and not everyone's going to have the luxury of being able to just go to Fiji and work on a computer. But I do think that there's going to be a lot of people, and it's already happening, that are saying, you know what, I don't have to live in San Francisco, or I don't have to live in a big city, and I can go somewhere and still have my job and have a lawn and have a house or whatever the case may be. And giving people the opportunity to be at home with family members, you know, that could be, and still is, of course, especially for moms. But yeah, I'm really optimistic that this is going to be a lot of positive shifts in a quick time that we've been waiting for.
I love that. I feel like mine's a little bit more self-centered, but maybe in the same spirit. I have loved working from home, been very, very grateful to have the opportunity to do that and see a lot of positivity there. I think the thing I'm looking forward to the most is getting back on an airplane. I haven't left Colorado by plane in, I think, over a year. And I'm just really excited. I'm excited to visit family that lives elsewhere. I'm excited to go on a vacation. I'm excited to go to the weddings that I haven't been able to go to or that were canceled or postponed. So I'm excited for flying and friendships and fun to be had in the sky. I'm not sure that that's happening in 2021 in the early side of it, but maybe by next holiday season.
Fair.
I certainly hope so. I miss flying.
I like your optimism.
Thank you.
Me too. It's definitely one of the things that I miss the most about having a job, you know, other than being able to pay all of my bills. I'm excited for vaccine pending. I'm really excited to go back to work, you know, in a new, different way than I did before, but I'm excited to do makeup again. It's something that is such a big part of my life and has been such a big part of my life, and safely touch people's faces for a living is something that I'm really looking forward to.
I can't wait for the day. Can I be one of your first?
Absolutely. You can fly here. I'll do your makeup.
We'll fly. We'll do it all. Catherine can work from your basement. It'll be like the trifecta of dreams come true.
Well, that was a really light, fun episode to go into the New Year's, guys. Yay! Thank you. And, you know, thanks to all of you for listening. We really, really appreciate that we have this small but mighty group of people listening to us. So please rate and subscribe. It would really mean a lot. You can follow us on social media at Blood Sweat Careers on Instagram. And you can also send your notes of admiration to bloodsweatcareerspod@gmail.com. So we look forward to seeing you next week. And thanks again for listening.
Yahoo!
See you next year.
Bye.